83% of IPOs in the first three quarters of 2018 were unprofitable.
That's right.
Prior to them going public. And it was a record. A lot of companies are just going out without that real business in place or with the idea that they are going for this grand slam.
Frankly, I would say we are seeing way too much similarity between these IPOs and what you would see in early stage pitch decks, which is selling on a story and selling on a narrative.
What do Airbnb, Pinterest, Lyft, Uber, Slack, and Stripe have in common? The answer is that they're part of a new wave of IPOs coming out of Silicon Valley. But what do these newly public companies mean for the broader tech industry? And what's in store for them in the future, especially with many of them not yet profitable? We'll explore those questions and that topic on this episode of the GeekWire podcast with a special guest who you'll meet in just a moment. But first, as you'll hear, we started off with a game, a mystery document to set the stage. Hey, everybody. Welcome to a special edition of the GeekWire podcast. I'm GeekWire editor Todd Bishop.
I'm GeekWire co-founder John Cook.
And we're pleased to be joined in the GeekWire studio by Ben Gilbert, the co-founder of Pioneer Square Labs and the co-host of a podcast that you should be listening to if you're not, Acquired. It's great to have you here, Ben.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
You and your co-host, David Rosenthal, dissect not only acquisitions, but big deals in tech. And you talk about all sorts of different companies and their history. And I have for you a mystery document to kick off discussion. In fact, it's coming in straight off. Kara Kuhlman on our team is bringing it in right now.
Todd, am I allowed to look at this too?
Yes,
I don't know anything about this.
We have two copies for the two of you. And this is going to kick off our discussion of the A-plus companies, which may be too much of a hint for this particular document.
I actually knew by looking at their 2018 revenue and then double-checked on their 2017 revenue what this was.
Okay.
So I have to try to figure this out.
Exactly. So before we jump in, let's explain. We started this concept on our Numbers Geek podcast with Steve Ballmer. We presented Steve with, at one point, a basketball box score. At another point,
great episode.
That was fun. Another point, we gave him the income statement for what turned out to be Ford, and then he told the story behind his family's legacy with Ford over the years. And so this is...
Well, don't... I'm still trying to figure it out.
So this is an income statement for a well-known company that happens to be part of this trend that we're talking about, this new wave of tech IPOs. So Ben, it sounds like, knows it.
Yeah, because he studies the numbers. Yeah, he cheats.
Could you both just walk me through what you see, Ben, in your case, without trying to actually decide what it is or solve it yet?
Yeah, so the first number I look at is the 2018 revenue, which in this case is $756 million. I could start moving down and look at sort of expenses, but as a sanity check, I want to sort of see how fast is this company growing. And I looked at their 2017 revenue, which is $473 million.
So growing very fast.
Yeah.
Yep.
And $298 million in 2016. So this is a very fast growing company.
And then $756 million. In 2018 is
and
the revenue.
And then I always go to the net loss as my next thing immediately after revenue.
Ever the optimist, John.
But But they've cut their net loss.
Yeah, they're close.
So
they've cut their net loss. So that's interesting because it runs counter to many of the other tech companies that you're seeing go public these days.
So walk through the numbers there. So in 2016, they were at $182 million. Of a net loss, so negative $182 million, then negative $130 million in 2017, and they've cut that down to negative $62 million on the bottom line in 2018.
So they're moving in the right direction.
Yeah, and at a relatively quick clip. I mean, I could see this company being profitable in the next year or two.
And this is a recent company that has either filed to go public or has gone public. Am I looking at this correctly?
Yes. So this is part of the trend, the A-plus trend. Is that how you say it? We'll explain what that means in just a second.
Yeah.
John, any ideas?
Well, if it's in that class, I have two ideas. I thought Zoom, which have they already gone out or are they?
They have already gone
out. Yeah. So I thought they were already profitable. So I don't think it's Zoom.
They are already profitable.
Yeah, so that knocks them out. It's certainly not Uber or Lyft, which are losing massive amounts of money. You know, so that's not the case. So I am going to say that leaves only a few others out there in this new class. I think I'm gonna say Pinterest.
Ben?
You nailed it, John.
Yes. All right. The mystery doc solved.
So is this income statement representative of the financials of the companies that we're seeing go public in this next wave, Ben?
You know, it is in that, you know, gosh, this company's gonna do $1 billion in revenue here soon. And so I think that's the sort of class of companies that we're seeing go public. But it's not in that their losses are narrowing and they're very close to profitability.
And when you think about the costs associated with a company like Pinterest, I mean, they're pretty minimal. I mean, it's more of like the old school internet company business versus an Uber or a Lyft, which have drivers and regulation and all this craziness going on. Pinterest can run a more profitable business. So
yeah,
the economics of this do look a lot better than what you see on those transportation companies.
As my esteemed co-host on Acquired, David Rosenthal, said, and I thought this was astute, this is a classic technology business, really high fixed costs, and in fact ran really high fixed costs with no revenue for a long time, 5 years into the business, and then, you know, very great margins and very super low variable costs as you start to monetize the business.
What is their I don't know much about Pinterest. I don't spend. Is it sponsorship and advertising is their main advertising business?
It is. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So that's a lot of advertising revenue flowing through Pinterest.
So I started with a game there. Let's take a step back. So Ben, you have a long history in the tech industry. You worked at Microsoft. You worked on Office for iPad.
Yep.
What was your position there?
I was a program manager working on the UX.
And then you went on and you led Microsoft Garage, which is their internal
grassroots innovation group.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. And then you have since joined Pioneer Square Labs. You co-founded Pioneer Square Labs. Mm-hmm. For people who don't know what PSL is, as they say in the biz, what is it?
Yeah. So Pioneer Square Labs is a startup studio and venture capital fund, an early stage fund. So on the startup studio side of our business, we co-found companies. We work with entrepreneurs from the very earliest stages on our ideas or their ideas with a big team of everything from engineers to designers to business people and data scientists, and we really try and test fairly ruthlessly ideas and frankly kill about 9 out of 10 of them. The remaining ones we spin out as companies to go and hopefully grow on their own. And then the PSL Ventures, the venture side of our business, is a $80 million early stage venture capital fund.
That's great. And so you, as part of your interest in technology and acquisitions and IPOs and M&A deals, started this podcast with David Rosenthal 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah,
now?
Close to 4 years now.
Yeah. For folks who have not listened to Acquired, give us your story of what it is.
Yeah. So Acquired tells the stories of great companies. And it started out really just focusing on acquisitions and really only ones that went well. And, you know, the more that we got into it, the more we realized that a lot of these companies just had incredible stories behind them. And of course, we center the episodes around a transaction, and we always issue a sort of trademark grade at the end. Was it a good idea to buy that company? Did that IPO go well for the company? Depending on whether it's an acquisition or IPO. But it really focuses on talking about everything from the founding and all the deep research we do there all the way through where they are today and speculate wildly on their future.
That's great. So the reason we wanted to have you in is because you and David have been having a ton of fun, starting with the Lyft IPO, with this new series, this new wave of companies that people are calling A+, which stands for
Airbnb, Pinterest, Lyft, Uber, Slack. And if you want to throw Stripe in there, you can as well.
So there's where Pinterest comes in. Tell us your big picture thoughts on what's happening right now in IPOs. What sparked this wave? What does it mean for the tech industry? Where are things headed?
Well, 3, 4, 5 years ago, a lot of us were sort of lamenting that there was this trend of stay private longer, that more and more cash was entering the private markets, typically that public company investors were coming earlier stage and investing in private companies. And that just allowed a lot of these companies to stay private, be quote unquote startups, even at enormous scale, and not go public. And triggered by a variety of things, including the sort of economic climate that we're in, the fact that the public markets are going well, and frankly, the fact that Uber had to go public based on some contracts that it had from its previous financings, the doors are wide open and we're seeing this whole vintage of technology companies go public at once, which frankly, you know, is very exciting and I think pretty inspiring so far.
We've seen this in Seattle. There was a mini wave of these over the past couple
years. Yeah, Seattle was the trendsetter on the IPO wave, wasn't it?
Always is. Yeah. The quiet trendsetter.
Yes.
Redfin, DocuSign.
Smartsheet. Apptio. Yeah.
Yeah.
So good class of companies that got out there mainly, and you saw that with Apptio and Smartsheet, more on the enterprise software side of things. And so what's interesting, and it is a little bit of a contrast of Seattle versus the Valley. Coming out of the Valley, you've got Airbnb and Pinterest and Uber and Lyft, and they're more on the consumer-oriented side of things, and you have the enterprise wave. Now, if you look at the stats, and Ben, you probably have them, but I think that the enterprise software companies that have gone out into the public marketplace have performed much better than any of the consumer-oriented companies.
Good hypothesis.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'll have to look that up. I don't have the stats on it.
What are the risks here? Because you are talking about, in many cases, companies that are not yet profitable, which I still have. Maybe I'm a traditionalist, but I do have a bit of a problem with that. You're still trying to convince the public that your story is strong long-term. And especially if you look at Uber, you know, I did the mystery document for Steve Ballmer, one last one when we were meeting with him last, and I did Lyft. And I did Lyft because Uber's income statement was a complete mess.
Dead giveaway, too. I think they're IPOing with a greater net loss than any company in history.
I would not be surprised.
I got to finish my research before that episode, but that's what I believe.
What are the risks here if these companies are not profitable and yet they're going public?
Yeah. Well, one key risk, and I think we're in the clear here, was that there was going to be a wild mismatch in how public investors valued these companies versus the way that the private markets had been doing that. And what we would have seen, if that were true, is in the Lyft and Pinterest IPOs, pricing dramatically under their last rounds. Lyft has had a little bit of a hiccup where it's traded down since its IPO, but it's still above its last private valuation. Pinterest is well above its last private valuation. And so one of the key risks that, frankly, I was worried about that was, are we as a private tech industry overvaluing these companies in a way that will be some serious heartache for everyone in the whole industry when they go public? Is that going to catch up to us? So far, we appear to be over that hurdle. I would say the risk that we still have left is that public investors are buying into what is still a lot of risk and a lot of unknowns about these businesses. And, I think even though they stayed private longer, a lot of these companies believe that they're entering just the largest global markets in history. And so they're willing to take on losses for longer and in very large amounts at the expense of growth. And so the retail investors and everyone buying stocks is now, has the potential reward, but is also taking on the risk of what if these companies or the one that you pick doesn't become profitable.
Well, the other thing that's interesting is that the time that it's taking these companies to go public, in part because of what you were talking about, Ben, the amount of money that was available in the private markets for so long that kept these companies going without having to go the IPO route, has put them in a place where they've been in operation for many years operating. Mm-hmm. And usually you would like to see your business click and have the profits start to kick in at that point of time. So I guess that's just not happening here because they believe it's just this gigantic market opportunity in this giant bet. But I would argue there were some pretty big bets placed when, you know, the software industry was getting born or the mobile phone industry was getting born that are potentially even bigger than what we're talking about here.
Couple points there. One, a lot of these companies, including Uber and Lyft I know for sure, Uber I believe, are actually unit profitable. So the cost of goods sold for each transaction are less expensive than the revenue that they're making from them. However, when you work in things like cost to acquire a customer, which are often not as clear in these documents, and they don't have to be, but it's interesting how we as early stage investors get to see those in seed and A and B decks, and yet they're not showing up in some of these IPO prospectuses, which gives me a little bit of pause and a little bit of heartache. So I would say, while I'm worried about the kind of obfuscation of that, it is worth knowing if these companies did decide to stop growing and actually just operate their business with their existing customers, you know, on a unit basis, they are making money. And so we're not sort of, it's not like the days of 99 where we're spending money to get people to our website to be users and we're not, you know, profitable on sort of each of those transactions. We just don't know sort of what will happen when they stop growing.
And to your point, Ben, I happen to be looking at Uber's income statement here for the calendar year 2018, $11.3 billion in revenue. Cost of revenue was $5.6 billion. So, and then on top of that, they had $3.1 billion in sales and marketing. So you can see where they are on a unit basis, mm-hmm. as you're saying, profitable.
Yeah.
But when you add in the sales and marketing, the R&D, all the stuff that they're doing to make sure they're growing
in the future, yeah.
Then the basically the operating income is a loss.
And Todd, wouldn't it be nice if we could actually see their businesses broken out there individually, Freight, Uber Eats, and Uber's core platform mobility business?
Okay, so I did not look at the S-1 in that much detail. The S-1 registration statement, which companies file when they are planning to go public, they did not break those things out.
There are different things broken out in different ways, but it is difficult, if not impossible, to fully analyze each of their businesses individually.
Interesting. You're listening to the GeekWire podcast, and we will be right back after this break.
Technology moves fast. I need to move faster. WGU's competency-based education puts me in control of how fast I move through my IT degree program. I can accelerate my program by applying what I already know to my courses and focusing on the things I need to learn. Earn a respected accredited degree that propels your career in the IT field. Learn more at wgu.edu/IT certs included.
Let's jump back into our conversation with Ben Gilbert, the co-founder of Pioneer Square Labs and co-host of the podcast Acquired.
Uber is planning to go out at about $100 billion valuation. What do you think of that? Is that about right or is that overvalued?
Well, it is noteworthy that they were planning to go out at $120 billion and they've revised
that. And then they saw
down.
What happened to Lyft.
and other factors, yes. I think. But yes, it's a big bet on the future. It gives me a little bit of heartache, but I think you can only know by being in that business and having access to all the data. I think the plan makes sense to me. I just don't actually know how it's going.
It seems like a big part of this bet is on the future of transportation as it relates to autonomous vehicles. And mm-hmm. both Lyft and Uber are investing extremely heavily in this realm. But there's no guarantee that Lyft or Uber are the ones that figure out that technological problem.
Huge risk. Huge
and
risk.
So if that's, you know, how much of the valuation, that $100 billion is tied into them being the ones that figure out autonomous vehicles, going up against the Fords and, well, you know, GM's an investor in some of these companies. But it seems like a really big challenge.
And your skepticism is well informed on that front, John, because you took a ride Taylor
yes.
Soper.
I didn't know where you were going with that. In Pittsburgh.
In a self-driving Uber and had kind of a harrowing experience.
They have a long way to go.
This was prior to the accident in Arizona.
Some anecdata going on.
Yes, exactly.
Well, we hit a pothole and it sent the computer system adrift and the driver had to take control of the system. So
yeah, exactly. But to your point, at $100 billion, even though that's less than what they were talking about, it's still basically in the realm of a tenth of Microsoft's market cap. Now, I realize you're talking about a company in Microsoft's case that's been around since the mid-70s. So you would hope that they would have figured out their business well enough to
and
have...
And they sell software.
Yeah, exactly.
So they don't have to have cars on the roads.
Yes, total apples and oranges, I recognize. But I'm wondering, why not Seattle? And I don't mean to be such a homer on this, but, like, you know, we're home to two of the most valuable companies in the world, in Amazon and Microsoft. At times, depending on the daily stock trading, they can be the two most valuable companies in the world. Why aren't these companies in this new wave of IPOs coming out of Seattle?
You know, that's a great question. I think we're well teed up for the next wave. I think we now have, how many unicorns are there? Rover, Outreach,
Convoy
and OfferUp.
And yeah.
That's right. And some others sort of in the pipeline. And I think you're right. This wave doesn't have any in Seattle. You know, the genesis of each of these companies is a little bit different. So it's hard to sort of generalize across these five and say they were all started in some similar way that companies aren't started here. But, you know, frankly, the Valley just has a tremendous amount of network effects and a flywheel in motion. And it just takes time. To go back to your question, John, on is it worth $100 billion, there's no discounted cash flow statement here that will show you that some multiple of earnings over some number of years makes this worth $100 billion because earnings are negative. And so the way that you sort of have to analyze it is, you know, if they got profitable and started generating earnings and try and come up with some reasonable amount of time to forecast that over, and then on top of that, how badly the demand outweighs the supply for shares. And so it's one of these things where, sure, there's some, you know, price that you can calculate that it should be worth, but then you also look at the excitement to be in what people believe could be a winner-take-all global phenomenon here, and that's why we're seeing that crazy price tag.
So now I'm going to put you on the spot.
Yeah.
As a venture investor
yeah.
and as an investor of the new crop that's coming out,
good.
Which one would you put Oof. The biggest Oof. Bet on?
With
coming
your own,
out, coming
with your
out,
own money.
Coming out at IPO.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess not that you got in early in the first seed round of Uber or Pinterest.
That's interesting.
Because what would you be looking for at this stage? That's kind of the fundamental question, right?
You know, it's not in the A+, and I certainly wouldn't buy it at the price that it's traded up to, but Zoom was incredibly intriguing to me. I mean, you saw a company that its last private valuation was $1 billion, go public at 9 and is now up at 16. Investor appetite is so clearly hungry for a good business, for a good profitable business at that scale that continues to grow like crazy.
So why don't we see more of those? I mean, if you just look at the economics of it, you go out, what did you say? You're out at 9 and then you're at 16 billion. Wouldn't you rather do that than go out at 100 billion and be at 50 billion?
I think these businesses are crazy hard to build. I mean, I'll be very curious to see what Slack's prospectus looks like when they, in all likelihood, actually do a direct listing, much like Spotify, instead of selling shares to new investors. But I think that business could look similar in that it is
similar to Zoom.
Similar to Zoom. And it follows the same characteristics where you finally have a good product in the enterprise, in a category. That product has network effects baked in, and people can easily sign up. So people, you know, there's a massive long tail of people paying a little bit of money, and then it scales nicely, and entire organizations end up getting upsold. It's the same playbook, that sort of consumerization of the enterprise.
Yeah, and the trend line, just going back kind of the profitable companies versus unprofitable companies, you know, the stat that we were talking about in the prior to the show was that 83% of IPOs in the first three quarters of 2018 were unprofitable.
That's right.
Prior to them going public. So and it was a record. And I mean, this speaks to a lot of companies are just going out without that real business in place or with the idea that they are going for this grand slam.
Frankly, I would say we are seeing way too much similarity between these IPOs and what you would see in early stage pitch decks, which is selling on a story and selling on a narrative.
And then being the history major here, I got to go back to the days of the dot-com boom, you know, because this is what it was. These money-losing companies. Now, in this case, they didn't have any revenue. I mean, they really were just – they didn't have revenue and they had massive – net losses, right? So yeah. I guess a little bit different that they are actual businesses here. But you got to wonder if these companies are going to really survive in the way that, you know, this next generation of companies like an Apple or Microsoft or Amazon came out. Nothing with the economics that are looking like these companies.
Certainly not. Not all of them will. It's interesting, though, to go back to your previous question. I think enduring companies are going to be Slack, Stripe,
Zoom, like Zoom,
Airbnb, and then in ride sharing, I think we're going to end up seeing a lot of consolidation, and we're going to end up seeing lower market caps.
Which is really interesting because one of the things that I loved about the podcast that you did on Lyft, and I had to listen to it over like three, because I think it was an hour and a half.
It was more than 2 hours.
Yeah, it was a lot. So I had to do it like Game of Thrones, you know, watch it in the segments or listen to it in segments.
Serializing.
Yeah, exactly. But it was really interesting. I had forgotten so much of the backstory there, but like Lyft tried to sell itself to Uber.
Oh, yeah.
And so you could imagine, what would it have looked like if Uber had knocked out their main competitor, and then Uber kind of let the door open when they had all their delete Uber and all the controversies related to the company. So they had multiple opportunities to just knock them out for good, and they were unable to do it. But you can just imagine, maybe it would be worth $100 billion if there wasn't a second competitor in the market running against them.
Maybe.
Or do you think somebody else would have emerged?
I actually wonder if it's value creative for Uber for Lyft to exist so that they don't go into antitrust.
Mm.
I think that...
True, but as you said, the economics on it, like just imagine what they could pay drivers if
they would stop spending into oblivion on acquiring riders and drivers. Yeah. That's definitely true. There's an interesting point here, and this was something that was brought up to me by Brad Stone, who wrote The Everything Store and the Upstarts.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was on an old episode of Acquired, and he's just a really thoughtful guy. And he brought up the idea that ride-sharing businesses actually don't have as strong of network effects as, say, an Airbnb, where it crosses markets. If you look at, like, let's say I want to take an Uber here in Seattle in the United States. I don't ever need to book an Uber in the UK when I travel there. And it's not that much more work for me to download a new app when I'm there. And so I'm not sure that there is sort of a global, there's necessarily someone that's going to globally dominate ride sharing the same way that there is in e-commerce or in home sharing or in some of these other industries. And so I think a lot of these assumptions are predicated on the fact that it's going to be winner take all. And I'm not so sure it is.
So in that regard, next spin out from PSL, it's obviously a ride sharing company, right?
I mean, I can't disclose that. Yes.
But you did have experience building an app in this
very
this
early stage. Yeah, yeah. We started a company called Red Ride. This is
I didn't know this.
You didn't listen to the show.
This is one of my first entrepreneurial endeavors. Started a company called Red Ride that was the Kayak of ride sharing in really early days. But nobody wanted to be aggregated yet, and nobody had to play ball because there was so much growth ahead of them. It was 2013, and so ultimately Uber pulled off our platform, and there was nothing we could do about it, and so shut down the company.
That's fascinating. No, what happens is I end up doing chores around the house while I'm listening to podcasts, and I miss key moments like when I'm turning on the water for the dishes. That's what's actually happening.
Listeners, feel free to go do the dishes right now.
But one of the things that struck me as you were talking about that with Uber and Lyft is it's kind of like the Harlem Globetrotters approach, right?
Mm.
The Harlem Globetrotters wouldn't have existed if not for the Washington Generals to beat up every game. So there, are you saying
that's an analogy?
That's tough. That's maybe a little unfair.
A little too harsh. Okay.
Though I do think even in a given city, I'm not sure that it's winner take all because
I agree with that. I have both apps and I use them interchangeably.
And all you need is once you have enough supply side to make it so that as you scale your demand side, that ride can arrive within 3 minutes. You can't optimize beyond that. Whereas if you think about like an e-commerce business, every single product that Amazon adds benefits every single customer because it's one more thing you could possibly buy on Amazon. I don't care if my Uber's already within 3 minutes and there's 500 more Ubers on the platform.
As long as that one is there
totally.
For you. Yeah.
Totally.
We're going to take a quick break here on the GeekWire podcast. But first, I wanted to note, since we recorded this podcast last week, Slack has released its S-1 registration statement. So you can see all of those financial details that Ben Gilbert alluded to. Plus, Ben and his co-host, David Rosenthal, have published their latest Acquired episode about Pinterest. And you can find links to both of those at geekwire.com/podcast and in the show notes on this episode. We'll be right back. Ben, I know you made copious notes, more notes than either John or I did coming in.
Look at that compared to my scribbles.
What have we not yet covered that's on your note and perfectly typed out? Look at this.
I found one piece of information totally fascinating in Uber's S1 that almost half of their rides are under 3 miles. And they later say in their prospectus that they believe that at some point in the future, all of their rides under 3 miles will be cannibalized by other mobility services such as dockless bikes and e-scooters, which is so clearly why they're investing, you know, incredibly heavily in those categories, as is Lyft, you know, as is Bird as an independent company, and Livin as an independent company. You know, John, I can see your heartburn over there.
Yeah.
Already running a massive loss business and then talking about that 46% of your revenue is going to get cannibalized by a product line that's brand new and who knows.
Yeah. You know what I say to this?
What's
walk. How is Uber going to, you know, monetize me walking? They're probably figuring it out.
Now,
right?
That's a good question. I wouldn't put it past them.
I do think scooters compete with walking.
Yeah.
So I walk to work. It's a 30-minute walk from Capitol Hill to Pioneer Square. So I have a Bird scooter. I'm a Bird ambassador. And a lot of times I will Bird from one place to the other. It is effectively very efficient walking. And when, you know, you travel to cities where they're all over the place and you guys have ridden scooters before, it competes with walking, and it's cheap enough. Like, I think that is how Uber will monetize walking.
On the scooter point, how are they going to monetize that, build out that network? There are so many regulations. There are cities like Seattle that are pushing back against this. And were you able to look at the numbers of scooters and bike sharing compared to a automobile? And which is more profitable for the company?
I haven't dug in that far yet.
I will say on Uber's business model, I don't know if they still offer this in other markets, but I tried this for a while. The Ride Pass, the monthly subscription where you pay a one subscription fee, I think it was like $25 or something like that. And then you got rides for like a flat $5. Am I remembering this correctly?
Yeah, this was a good deal. It was probably too good of a deal that they got rid of it.
Well, I think I ruined it because I just basically left my car at home at that point. Because when you compare
that. You notice
they're
not doing that anymore.
Exactly.
Or else they'd be losing even more money.
But they changed it and it's a less appealing offering.
Yeah, because that to me, that kind of subscription offering is where you start choosing that over the walk, the 3-minute walk, and you can talk about the impact on the environment or, you know, your physical health. But still, it was very appealing when you compared it to not just the cost, the actual cost of parking someplace if you went downtown, but also just the time lost in finding parking.
Yeah. How much is Uber still struggling with the Travis Kalanick era? And emerging with Dara Khosrowshahi as the new CEO. I mean, having covered Expedia and Dara Khosrowshahi at Expedia, you know, there is a bet that you're putting here on management that he can transfer this company into the new new era and really build a massive business. And if anything gives me hope in Uber, it's like there's now some more professional executive
adult supervision.
Executive management team there that we've seen what he can do. Which you could put some faith in and use that as your rationale for investing. But how much of the baggage is still left of the old Uber versus the Dara Khosrowshahi Uber?
You know, I thought it was really a stand-up move for Dara's opening letter of the S-1 to address that head-on and talk about that Uber wouldn't be where it is today without a lot of the aggressive behavior of its past, but boy, do they have messes to clean up. From what I know of folks that work there at all levels, from the way that the board has sort of shifted around and the way that, you know, they've approached this IPO process, I think they're through it. I also think when you look at how the Delete Uber campaign saved Lyft and started Lyft's acceleration of stealing share from Uber, I don't think that's continued in the way that it did in the immediate aftermath. I think that Uber is sort of through that period. The story going forward for that company is not going to be about recovering from that. I think we're through that era.
You mentioned consolidation, and we had talked earlier about the fact that Lyft had merger and acquisition talks with Uber at one point. Do you see a scenario in the next, let's say, 2 years where Uber does buy Lyft?
I think it depends how poorly the market treats Lyft. If it continues to drop in valuation, yes, I do. Right now, since they're both money-losing businesses, it would end up being sort of a stock merger. So it would be that they both owned parts of the combined company. I think if Uber or Lyft, I mean, I think if there's someone that breaks free here and is able to run a great business that's throwing off cash, I think that will dramatically accelerate something like that happening.
Yeah, I'm just looking at Dara Khosrowshahi's letter here. And one interesting factoid from it is they say less than 1% of all driving globally is on Uber. So that's one way to look at it.
Well, I mean, there is a big headroom.
Bezos always talks about, you know, less than 10% of, you know, commerce is right. even done online. So
it's all how you frame the market.
Yeah. And I know I've been kind of a negative Nelly here on the money losing components of these businesses. But at the end of the day, if I look at my own behavior, and I know Ben, you're in this camp too, like I've shifted how I interact with an automobile. I mean, we got rid of our second car. We have one car. I walk now more. And I use Uber and Lyft a lot. And so if you believe that there's this bigger trend that people are going to shift away from car ownership in the traditional sense, there is the potential that these companies could really take off in a much bigger way.
You have your own personal story along these lines, Ben.
Oh, yeah. That was my GeekWire writing debut.
Yes, awesome. I remember that. It was inspirational for me. I followed in your footsteps.
Yeah, it's at some point I crunched the numbers when I was, I think, 25 and living on Capitol Hill. And the parking and the insurance for someone in my category and the fact that my car was mostly just sitting in a garage inspired me to do the math. And I figured out I could save like $6,000 or something a year by ditching my car and going full Uber. And I want to take a privilege check here and just recognize that, you know, that was fairly unique to my situation. And that's not a thing that necessarily everybody could do. But yeah, I think more and more so the availability of these transportation options is shifting away from car ownership.
This has been fun. And I have to say, the thing that really inspired me to get you in here, Ben, was that you and David, the co-hosts of Acquired, the podcast, you're clearly having fun with this. I was telling folks in the news team, look at how excited these guys are about this.
Yeah, you put us to shame in terms of the level of research that you do. Todd and I just show up 5 minutes before and say, what are we talking about? So hats off to you.
hopefully we're living it during yes. the week enough to at least have a somewhat informed conversation.
Awesome.
But I mean, you guys, I mean, I think David, did he not sleep the night before your Lyft podcast?
He woke up early and then ran to the office where his recording studio is in San Francisco to do it. So yeah, we have a ton of fun. I mean, it's one of these things. It started as a passion project. It's still a passion project. Nobody listened for the first year. And the episode quality probably shows it if you go back in the archives, but it's just a joy to do.
So it's acquired.fm.
That's right.
It's the best place to find it on the web. Where else can people follow you and the show and Pioneer Square Labs?
Yeah. So we are at acquired.fm and I am at Gilbert on Twitter. Pioneer Square Labs is PSL.com. If you want to listen to Acquired, it's in every single podcast player you could possibly find us. So give us a listen. We'll be dropping Pinterest here soon and then Uber after that.
That's
great. Busy times on the Acquired front.
Busy times.
And yet you still found time to be a judge at the GeekWire Awards.
Yes. So. Nice segue, Tom.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that if people want tickets for that, it's still available.
It is.
GeekWire.com/awards.
Good plug.
You can see the results of the judging that Ben and our other panel, the rest of our panel of esteemed judges came up with.
And we'll see if any of our next Tech Titan finalists.
There you go.
Ooh.
Emerge.
That's right.
For an IPO or a large acquisition. So you have something, some additional content for a future episode.
I'll be there and I'm bringing a cadre of the Pioneer Square Labs team. So come hang out with us.
Awesome. That's coming up on
May 2nd.
GeekWire.com/awards. Ben Gilbert, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Until next time, I'm Todd Bishop.
And I'm John Cook.
Thanks for listening to GeekWire.